Today's second talk will discuss the interactions of Imam Khomeini with other faith groups and his outlook towards interfaith relations in general. To discuss this topic, we have with us Reverend Frank Julian Gelly. Dr. Gelly has just written a book, Julius Evola, The Sufi of Rome, and it's available on Kindle and Amazon. So without further ado, please welcome him to the podium with a loud salawat.
Assalamu alaikum. My good friends, in the name of the one true God, I salute you all. It's lovely being with you today. I want to start with a quotation of words of which the Imam Khomeini, once said. We who are all under the banner of monotheism, until we do become united and gather under the true nationality that belongs to us all, and until present in the public arena, we will not be able to resist this torrent of faithlessness which is overtaking the whole world. Now, the Imam spoke these words in 1982, and the theme of the discussion at the time was the unity and uniformity of the monotheistic schools. Now, 30 years later, the torrent of faithlessness has grown. It is now raging. It is like a scorching, boiling downpour of unbelief, of infidelity, of sins and wickedness. Or if you like, the torrent has become a flood of disgraceful wickedness. So the resistance, the appeal to the unity of monotheists, which the Imam spoke about 30 years ago, is more urgent than ever. Under the banner of monotheism, we believers in the one true God, in the truth that comes not from below, but from above, in the messages and the laws of the Creator, we should gather and fight. So we must fight unbelief, wickedness. We must give them no quarter. We must resist with that tsunami of faith, opposing this wave of unbelief with a wave of belief. Until, to quote the English poet Alfred Tennyson, we, in the name of that God, whoever lives and loves one God, one law, one element, and one far-off divine event to which the whole creation moves, until the laws of that God are acknowledged. I'm going to divide my paper in three parts. First, I will briefly mention some remarks which the Imam made at different times in his life on Christianity. Then I will offer my own remarks on those remarks. And last, I will boldly suggest what the Imam would like us to do today. What he would like us to do. So, first, some remarks on Christianity by Imam Khomeini. On Christmas Day, 1979, which is the anniversary of the birth of Jesus Christ, he addressed a number of clergy, I imagine Americans, who were visiting him in Qom, and the context must have been probably the hostage crisis which had developed at the time. And he said, everything Jesus Christ performed was a miracle. It was a miracle. He was born of a virgin mother. It was another miracle of his that he spoke while he was a baby in the cradle. It was miraculous that he brought peace, tranquility, and spirituality to mankind. And the Imam also suggested that the task of Christian clergy should be to start a spiritual combat, a combust against those powers that oppose the teachings of Jesus Christ. By which he meant, I suppose, I think he spelt it out, Christian, so-called Christian governments and rulers who claim to be Christians, but were actually, in fact, working against the teachings of Jesus Christ. Priests, he urged, have to instruct those oppressive governments and statesmen and show them the true path. 5 years later, in 1978, again on the eve of Christmas, from his French exile in a small village near Paris, the Imam offered felicitations and best wishes to a Christian of the world. He mentioned Christ, the Son of Mary, the Spirit of God, the Honourable Prophet who reawakened the dead, His Holy Mother, Virgin Mary, and virtuous saintly woman. And he gave greetings to all the Christians and clergy. He asked the clergy to warn the heads of some Christian countries which support the oppressive Shah through their diabolical powers and crush a nation under their oppression. And he urged those clergy, acquaint those statesmen with the teachings of Jesus Christ. Well, I have some more quotation, but I think by now you have understood the high opinion in which the Imam held Christian. But I also mentioned one brief anecdote, which I think is significant. The village in which the Imam lived at the time in France, Neuf-le-Château, is a tiny place. And when the Imam went to live there, it was quickly invaded by hordes of journalists, of photographers, and so on. Naturally, it disturbed the peace and quiet of the local people. So it was not the Imam's fault, of course, but he was aware of that. So he instructed his staff to go and apologize to the local inhabitants for the disturbance. And he asked them to, he asked his staff to offer flowers and sweets to the local people. I think it's a lovely gesture. You do something sweet and to the people who are your hosts, and suggest the kindness and good feelings he had for the local people. Now, my second part is some reflections on the Imam's remarks. So I want to pick out one crucial strand. When he urged priests and monks and fellow religious leaders and monasteries to engage in a spiritual combat against the powers that deny and refuse the teaching, the true teaching of Christ, this is a position which takes us to the heart of the matter, namely the Imam teaching that Islam implies no separation between religion or spirituality and politics. There is a famous episode, which some of you may know, sometime before the revolution, the head of the feared secret police of the Shah, the Savak, went to visit Imam Khomeini, and he gave a strange, cynical argument to try to win him over. He said, "You're a spiritual man, you're pious, you're religious, but politics is dirty, politics is bad, it's corrupt. So why do you want to get into politics? You just stay with your religion, do not dirty your hands, leave politics to us." Well, the Imam's reply was terse, immediate. "All of Islam is politics," he said. "Islam doesn't just mean performing salat or namaz, the ritual prayers, the hajj, the pilgrimage. Praying and pilgrimage form only one section," he said, "of the laws of Islam. Islam deals with politics, with administering a country," and he referred also to the versicles in the Quran which has to do with ritual and those which have to do with social affairs, and the latter are far more numerous than the former. Now, in a speech which later on the imam gave, he mentioned the separation, the idea of separation between religion and politics, a colonialist plot. And those, he called those Muslim jurists and ulama who supported a concept of separation from religion and politics as courtier clerics, people subservient to a ruler. They were just serving the interest of the, it's a word that comes from the Quran, tagut, taguti politicians, he said, servants of tyrants who were not genuine Muslims and who were in hoc to colonialists and imperialists in their various forms. And I'm reminded about what another famous Islamic revolutionary, the Mario Sudan, said about some ulama who were actually not doing their job. He called them ulama su, scholars of evil. And I don't want to insult anyone, because we got lots of priests of su in Christianity, I'm afraid. So the Iranian revolution is the great legacy that the imam has left us. It has startled and shocked the West, a revolution against history, it was called, against modernity, and by that they meant it was a revolution which did not reject God, unlike the French and Russian revolution, but it placed God at the heart of everything. It harmonized politics, religion, and society. So the revolution has inspired Muslims everywhere, and it does continue to inspire them, as well as to disturb those many kings, shuyukh, and sultans who are scarce of the possible implications of the revolution. Now, a brief comment on there's an idea which again also mentioned in, by the imam, but Christianity is different. And unlike Islam, in Christianity, politics and religion are separated. And there are two different spheres. Now, that is true of some sects, some marginal sects of Christianity, but it is not true of Christianity as a whole. I believe, actually, the imam did not really subscribe to that view, because when he urged Christians and clergy to criticize and even oppose their governments, he cannot really have believed that Christianity implied a separation of that. But just briefly, in this context, very often people, a famous episode in the Gospels, in the Injil, when Jesus Christ was challenged to, about tax, and he replied, give unto Caesar the state what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. And some people say Jesus Christ implied a separation between the two. But of course, if you read that passage, you will find that Jesus Christ had asked for a coin to be given to him, a coin. The coin had on one side the image of Caesar, the emperor of the state. Now, if you pick up a coin, any coin, you will notice one thing. The coin is a unity. It is two sides, but you cannot separate them. If you separate them, it breaks it up. So the state, if you like, society, and God are not two different realms. But unlike a coin, God is more important than the state. Jesus Christ didn't mean the emperor, the state, and God were on a par. God is higher than the state. The creator, Al-Khalik, is higher than the creature. So I quoted this because quite clearly, it is not the case that Jesus Christ wants to say religions, politics were different. When you shout Allahu Akbar, God is greatest. And as one Christian philosopher said, God is greater than anything than you can conceive. So it is not possible to say that God and politics equal and distinct God is enveloping society, the world, everything else. So, also historically, very briefly, it is not the case that Christianity has seen society and the state as not subjected to the rule of God. The medieval popes, for example, claimed supremacy over emperors or the state, and Christian emperors were often deposed by popes when the emperors did not behave properly. Of course, there were Christian thinkers who warned against an excessive emphasis of religion in public life, and there were some people, even Islam, who maintain that you can't, if you sort of bring too much of the influence of religion in society, it damages religion. Well, that's an argument for you, but I believe actually today we have the opposite problem. We must bring God's revelation into a public arena and not keep it up. So, today, because of the overwhelming separation and secularization of society, the churches have fewer influence, but of course, for example, the Catholic Church has an official teaching, a magisterium, an authoritative teaching on questions of morality, and it does speak. The Pope, the bishops speak on social matters like marriage, the family, abortion, unemployment, war, immorality, promiscuity, and similar matters. So it is not correct to say that Christianity sees itself as merely spiritual in the sense of being otherworldly, unconcerned with social and political issues. I'm a priest of the I'm a Protestant, in a sense, Church of England. And my church today, alas, has largely succumbed to secularism, but it was not always so. It was the Church of England, in fact, is intertwined with English society. There are 26 bishops which sit in the House of Lords. They are the Lord's spirituals. Today we're celebrating, supposed to be celebrating the Queen's Jubilee, but should we not actually lament and mourn? Because where is God in public life? Where is God in the life of the English nation, which used to be a Christian nation? So, I think I have made my point, and the Church does not see itself as merely otherworldly, ethereal and wishy-washy. On the contrary, God and the state are ultimately one, like my example of the unbreakable coin. Now, Imam Khomeini, great respect for Jesus Christ, was rooted in the message of the Quran on Christ being declared a great prophet, as the words I quoted suggest. I ought to tell you, because I'm not here to lie to you, you don't want me to be a hypocrite, a monarch. I think I want to tell you what is the case. Christianity does not see the rank of a prophet as the highest possible rank. In Islam, it is. In Christianity, when in the Quran he speaks of Isa al-Masih, we take the title of Masih as a title which is above that of prophets, a higher title. So although we have so much in common, I must not lie to you, I must not pretend that there are no differences. And lastly, I come to my final part, what would the Imam wish us to do today? I will make sort of four brief points. You will not disagree, I'm sure, when I say that the Imam would want us to defend the Iranian Revolution, to defend it and preserve its achievements. First, the hypocritical sanctions imposed by the US and the EU are trying to strangle Iran economically. I'm not wasting time to try to refute the charge that Iran is developing weapons of mass destruction. The Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has declared nuclear weapons, un-Islamic. And we ought to keep that in the forefront of public opinion. Second, a direct military attack by America or Israel is a dire possibility. It could happen. It could happen soon. We have witnessed a frequent assassination of Iranian scientists. It is frightening how we see the warmongering, the appetite, the hunger for bombing, which the United States, Britain, and the NATO display daily, from Afghanistan to Libya, and probably soon to Syria. The BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, which should be renamed the British Bombing Corporation, it always supports NATO bombing campaigns. We pay for the BBC, if you have a television, out of our fees. We pay annual compulsory fees. Let us flood the BBC with complaints about this despicable daily warmongering. Third, the deliberate undermining of the revolution takes the form also of moral corruption. The military undercover operation, terrorism waged daily against Iran. There is also moral and immoral or immoral subversion. I believe some time ago it was Ayatollah Khamenei, this picture just behind me, isn't it? Who mentioned we're not so much worried about military attack, it's the immoral forces with which the West is trying to attack Iranian culture. Destructive forces which have damaged Christian society in the West so much with wrong values. They are trying to impose them on Iran as well, on the Islamic world. So an opportunity for us, trying to be true monotheists, to constitute a popular front, an alliance of faith, an alliance of true monotheists against the armies of Shaitan or Darut of evil. And fourth, politics must become theological. This is a revolutionary task because it goes right against the present secular zeitgeist. It's a word meaning a spirit of the age, our phony age. But it is an imperative, spiritual and moral task. Plato, the great Aflatun, the great Greek philosopher, said that no true state, genuine state, would ever arise until philosophers become rulers. I would say no genuine state based on justice will emerge until the people of God, the theologians, the jurists, the sacerdotes, the bearers of the sacred, become rulers. And we have a good example in Iran. So there is a spiritual combat ahead. Let us not shirk our duty as fellow monotheists. Let us remember in the words of the New Testament that our battle is not just against flesh and blood, but against the powers, the world rulers of this present darkness, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness around us. Inshallah, we will vanquish them. Thank you.